Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
Caroline is back.
Yes.
From her many travels.
Yeah, in body, not really sure in mind. Or like
where have you been?
I've been to San Jose. That was last week. And then this week I've been in Paris. And now I'm back in Shoreditch.
Did you go and see the Haunted House?
She didn't see the Winchester Mystery House.
I did not have time.
It was so disappointing.
I flew in Wednesday. The conference was Thursday, Friday, and then I flew home. There was just no time for sightseeing.
Yeah, it's very frenetic in Paris as well.
Yeah, wow. I spent 48 hours I was there battling motion sickness most of the time.
Oh.
Just lots of cab rides across the city.
City of lights.
Yeah, to different bits of the conference, to the hotel, everything, and just spent a lot of time feeling a bit green the whole time.
But you're going to tell us a little bit about the content.
Yeah.
The conferences you went to, because
yeah.
You weren't just travelling.
No, I wasn't on a jolly. I had work to do, but all will be revealed in a bit.
And joining us for the second week on the trot is Alex Croxton.
I'm back.
Security editor. Welcome back, Alex.
Hello.
Alex partly is here because, as a security editor, very appropriate because we're going to give over the bulk of the podcast to a discussion of The Capture, BBC miniseries that's just finished airing this week when we record. Conspiracy thriller by Ben Channon. And as we did with Line of Duty, and we also did with Holby City.
Oh yeah.
Casualty. We'll try to focus on the technology side of things. Whether we succeed or not, we shall see. So this, in terms of tech, this drama brings together video surveillance with facial recognition thrown in. And the doctoring of that, so it kind of turns on that. If you've not seen it, then stop listening.
Spoiler alert.
Stop listening and go and watch it. Okay, welcome back. I'll try and give a brief summary, which is not going to be that easy because it's quite complicated in a sec. But first, what did we think of the ending?
I feel like it's set up for a season two that is completely not needed and unnecessary.
Yeah, it could be wrapped. It's quite a nice way of wrapping it up. I think, well, given you were going to do a summary, but never mind. But no, I was expecting the lead character to sort of blow the whole operation wide open. But then she didn't. So I was like, thanks.
I think there's been quite a lot of controversy about it. Yeah.
Because she'd been so principled up to that point. And then it's just like, actually, do I want more money?
Yeah, I think she's going up the...
She's very ambitious.
I feel like she's going undercover with it, though.
Otherwise, she
wouldn't have kept the video.
Yeah, that's true.
She'll be the mole in the next season.
Yeah.
If there is a next season.
She's going to get, so deep in there.
Because she has the video. She took it out of the... It was hiding in the
rice,
jar of rice, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You just put it behind the
jar.
Picture, yeah.
Other jars are available.
Okay, quick summary then. So there's two sets of protagonists in The Capture. You've got the security services broadly on one side, and a group opposed to them called the Pilgrims of Justice on the other. And it's all about a program called Correction, which is correcting video footage. Caught in the middle are our hero and heroine, or two heroes. Sean the Soldier. We first meet him as his conviction for killing a Taliban soldier in Afghanistan unlawfully is quashed because of a technical fault with video from the head camera. It's got out of sync vision and sound. And then the other big protagonist is Rachel, SO15 officer, which I think is counter-espionage. For the London Met, includes special branch and other bits and bobs. And she's been seconded to Sutton, I think.
Which
used to be the home of Computer Weekly. We were in Sutton for a very long time. It's the first time I've ever seen Sutton.
I didn't clock any actual Sutton locations. I was having a look when they started talking about Sutton. I think the where they the bus scene, the crucial video that the whole plot hangs upon.
Yeah.
I think that was shot by, in Croydon, where the tram link comes in on a flyover.
But
there was some shot in Battersea, in my manor as well, up near nice Battersea Square at one point.
And Sean the soldier, I think he's a Croydon boy, or he's from that neck of the woods.
Yeah.
So bit of local excitement there.
But she's been sent to basically learn to lead a bunch of wooden top police officers. Fast track benefits of her education, and she gets landed with what seems to be the abduction by Sean of his barrister, one Hannah Roberts. And then just the other major characters, you've got the US intelligence officer Frank, an MI5 officer Gemma, and Rachel's former boss and former lover, Commander Danny. So that's enough summary, I think. So my second question, really, for you guys is, who's in the right?
Because that was the whole point, isn't it? The tagline for correction is that they turn intelligence into evidence, because wiretaps wiretaps and intercepts aren't admissible in court. So they're saying, as C.I. Carey, so the lead character sort of makes a point, you know, do the ends justify the means in this?
Yes.
That because, you know, there are people doing bad things out there, there is evidence that can't be used in court against them, so they could walk free. So the use of technologies that allow you to fabricate videos or put them, make them appear they're in places where they've got evidence to suggest they were, is justified.
Yeah.
So it is a huge...
What's not like?
Yeah. And then they kind of justify it. We're like, oh, well, look, we could save millions of people from terrorist attacks, so therefore, you know, you have to have some collateral damage in this case, which is poor Hannah Roberts and...
Sean.
Yeah, Sean.
Yeah, and the boot of the car.
Yeah.
And Hannah's death is not intentional from the standpoint of the pilgrims.
No.
Is it? It's... I mean, she literally is collateral damage.
Yeah.
And D.I. Rachel Carey, you remembered where she was from earlier?
Holiday Granger, yes. Yeah. She's the able assistant Robin to Cormor and Strike in the Strike series of private detective stories written by Robert Galbraith, a.k.a. J.K. Rowling.
And Sean, I remember him from Fantastic Beasts.
Is he in
that? He is in that.
It's Harry Potter connections.
Yeah.
There were a lot of actors that have been in other things. I found it quite distracting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the nature of television drama.
Yeah.
The tedious tendency of people to have other jobs.
Yeah.
But Patrick Flynn, so the other detective.
I loved him.
He was really good. He was in one episode of The Inbetweeners.
Oh, so the mechanic when they did the work experience. I remember. I really liked him. He just wanted to get the job done, and then technology let him down at a crucial point.
Exactly.
When
he's not a high flyer though.
No. I wanted him to succeed so much, and I was like, no.
Wendy, what would have happened if he had have uploaded the bus video?
We might not have got a series 2. So.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
But it does open up a big can of worms morally, doesn't it? I mean, what would you do?
Well, I don't know.
If you can keep people safe and so on.
Yeah, but then it is dangerous though, because, and that was something that Emery started having in it, is that if you show people enough of a video, you start believing that it's happened.
Mm.
So that kind of could contradict the whole point of correction, because if you show people video and they go, actually, I was there that day, I didn't see that happen, but did I?
You have so many people...
start planting false memories.
So many people think that they remember being in places that they couldn't possibly have been because they have seen footage of it, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that this happened in New York during the 9/11 attacks, and people say they remember seeing or remember being in places where they couldn't possibly have seen the World Trade Center, but they saw it. And people's memories become very easily, it's very easy to manipulate that sort of thing, and if you repeat those messages enough times, I mean, it's I completely understand why Sean begins to have doubts during the course of the shows yeah. that he might have killed Hannah, that he doesn't know that he didn't.
Mm. Especially because he superimposes the image of Hannah with the real image of the soldier.
Yeah.
Because the soldier reaching out to him from the ground and then him shooting him anyway did happen.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, the Hannah thing didn't happen, but he sort of replaced, he meshed the two memories together.
Mm.
The guilt from one and then repeatedly being told about the other.
Mm.
Oh.
Because there's one thing to manipulate data, which I'm not saying you should do, but then to actually manipulate people, and then you're actually getting them to lie potentially under oath without realising if you plant those false memories. So that's
gaslighting by technology.
Yeah, exactly.
Really,
yeah.
Well, Caroline and I were drawing some comparisons between this and then Making a Murderer.
Oh yeah.
Not that Making a Murderer is obviously completely real, but we
so
were saying
Making a Murderer
is a Netflix.
It's a Netflix docuseries
okay.
about. The conviction of two people for the murder of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys that was convicted was previously arrested for a crime that he didn't commit and then was acquitted on forensic evidence, but then immediately was convicted for this other murder case.
Yeah.
And we were like, is that correction in action? Mm. Did he actually do it? And then one of the other guys as well that was apparently involved claims that his confession was coerced, so you have that repeatedly emotionally battering someone to and that's completely real.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know if the correction speculation
wow.
is real, but we know that, you know, this is a case and there is quite a lot of debate over whether he actually did it or not.
Yeah.
Whether he could have done it.
Yeah, and there is the whole false memories thing. One of the interviews with one of the people accused,
Brendan, who's
accused of the crime, and the officers are asking really leading questions in a way that it's just basically getting him to repeat what they've said.
Yeah,
and because he's got learning difficulties.
That's the way to put it.
So he so the way they're asking these questions, he doesn't realise potentially that he's being coerced into giving a confession.
So he's like,
you remember seeing her, don't you, laying there?
Yeah.
What room was she in? It was a living room, wasn't it? And he's like, yeah, I think it was the living room.
And if you hit her with something, what did you hit her with?
Yeah.
And it's like, this? No, it wasn't that. This?
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Mm.
Yeah, these are quite age old techniques, I guess, of interrogation and somebody up.
It's why you saw, why I think in the future, unless there is any kind of DNA forensic evidence, it will become harder and harder to, you know, be allowed to actually convict someone.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is where the space in which the capture kind of appears in a way, because it's that, you know, you can't get someone sent down reliably through the court system, so you kind of use some other technique. I mean, the British security services have done this a lot. There's the famous Loch Goll ambush in 1987, where the SAS took out an IRA unit because they weren't able to get these people through the courts in the normal way.
Yeah.
Their evidence was through wiretaps, and also the head of internal security of the IRA was actually an MI5 officer who knew, well, quite a few people, it turns out, knew that in the end. There was a good BBC doc, sounds like I just watched BBC, on about that recently, about the Troubles, and there's one episode that focuses on the Loch Goll ambush in particular. But it's, again, it's the same kind of technique, that because you can't get a conviction through the court, so what did the British state decide to do? Well, it just decided to kill them and put an end to them. Rightly or wrongly, I mean, you could debate that one. The other thing that the capture kind of reminded me of was, remember the Berlin lorry attack, the Christmas market?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
3 years back, 2016. Which eventually they tracked this guy down in Milan, a guy called Anis Amri. There had been another suspect as well, but when that happened, the immediate thing that I thought was, what about the CCTV?
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't they just... And the reason is, they don't have CCTV in the way that we do it in London. So if that happened in London, you would get an immediate response.
This is the most heavily surveilled city in the Western Hemisphere. certainly London. And I,
is it?
Well, I was watching, catching up on the capture on my way back from a trip out to Newport in Wales this week, and I was sitting there on the train as we were coming back into London. I set myself a little exercise, and I got off the train in Paddington to see just how many closed circuit cameras I could see or would have direct sight of me as I moved from the platform in the main station concourse down onto the Bakerloo Line platforms. And it was like, if you actually stop and start to pay attention to where these cameras are, there's very, very few. There are certainly no blind spots, as they discuss in the capture at Paddington Station. I was constantly within sight of a of an identifiable camera during basically a 5 minute walk.
Interesting.
At least 10, 15 different angles.
And I wanted to ask you, Alex, how realistic is the technology in the capture?
What do you want to know about deepfakes?
Can you recognise faces in real time?
Yes,
like,
that's possible. So those square, I mean, I'm not sure about the sort of 57% match to our suspect, 87% match. There he is walking down the street. I'm not sure how realistic that is. And there's a lot of this that was science fiction. I don't believe for a moment the CIA has the capacity to hack into London's CCTV system and insert its own footage, for example. But the facial recognition stuff, the little boxes that were appearing over people's faces, I have seen that in action on me. In fact, at a Huawei event in China, where they had a booth displaying some of this technology.
Well, I mean, that's how you unlock iPhones nowadays.
Yeah.
With the face. They map your face.
Yeah. Facial recognition technology is very good. Deepfake technology,
But on that mass scale, though.
Well, that's the thing. It's such a massive data exercise that its capabilities at this point, such as they are not really, unless there's something that we don't know about. I think a fairly educated security insider's guess would be that the capabilities aren't quite there yet.
Mm.
It's like AI in all sorts of situations. It's really just big data.
Yeah, it's computer vision stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, for data crunching.
Well, there was a campaign not that long ago, maybe in the last few years, where the police were looking for people who were known as, I think, super recognizers.
Mm.
So people who can look at a picture of a suspect and then look at pictures of other people or videos and see if they can tell whether or not it's the person that they're looking for.
Yeah.
And I think it was because the technology's not quite there yet that they needed these people who have like that super recognition skill that they were looking for.
Mm.
I'm not sure though.
I remember that.
I mean,
and the concept of a deep fake, putting someone else's face onto it, is that's done by using sort of competing AI systems, one of which spots inaccuracies in the generators video, and then the generator learns from that in future. And you know, deepfakes, such as they are, and such as I've forgotten his first name, the Levy character, upon
Marcus
whose evidence
Levy.
Marcus Levy, thank you.
He's my fave.
His line on multiple occasions was, you'll have seen the deepfake pornography, won't you?
And
that
is precisely why I was watching it. I was like, Marcus Levy should be, well, maybe a technology journalist, because he's trying to explain a concept to someone.
Yeah.
A complicated concept to someone who might not be as au fait with the technology as him. So what does he do? He tries to put it in terms that he thinks they relate to this. And then he realises, oh shit,
I'm the only one that's watched deepfake porn.
Yeah. I'm a perv.
That does exist and has been banned. Yeah. It was banned by, there was a Reddit, and this was where deepfakes first started to emerge in about 2017 on the R deepfakes. That was banned and shut down. Deepfakes are banned on Twitter and multiple other platforms, not 4chan and 8chan.
Well, probably.
Obviously, nobody can really control those places. But there were multiple high profile victims of deepfake pornography, including Gal Gadot, played Wonder Woman, Scarlett Johansson, Taylor Swift, Katy Perry, pretty much any high profile.
No men there.
No, not at all. Weird, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, Marcus Levy, another victim.
Yeah.
Another victim of the... I mean, he was in a coma, but still not great. Not a great outcome.
He might turn up series two.
Maybe.
A few bandages on. Yeah. Might make a full recovery.
That would be nice.
But the thing about deepfakes, which is really interesting, there's a really interesting article on Technology Review, which I probably shouldn't be talking about other
publications,
but I thought it was really interesting.
We're
because,
big enough, we can take
yes.
it.
But
American Computer Weekly.
So on the capture, it's all this like amazing, like let's create these really intricate deepfakes and stuff. But this sort of article makes the point that actually deepfakes aren't always that complicated. Sometimes it's just a case of slowing down a piece of footage. And then make it, there's like the one where they're like, oh, this politician, she's drunk talking, because they'd slowed down the way she was talking, so she sounded slurred. But then the other thing in the article, which is quite interesting, is that they were saying the actual scale of deepfakes out there, like the number of videos out there, is actually, there's not that many of them, they're not that sophisticated, but it's people's fear of them, and like because it's talked about so much, which is something I think the capture might actually contribute towards.
Yeah.
People are so suspicious of everything they see now that it actually, oh, that's deep fake, I'm not going to believe it. And it actually feeds into all the Trump kind of fake news stuff.
There are shallow fakes, which is, I think, what you're referring to.
Yeah.
And there is, in fact, a relevant Computer Weekly article that could have cited, but.
What's that?
I know that because I wrote it.
Yeah.
I think.
The
very famous example of this is the Jim Acosta controversy, where Jim was a CNN, he got reinstated in the end, I believe, CNN's White House correspondent, was at a press conference asking Trump some questions that he did not like. A White House staffer tried to remove the microphone from him. Jim pulled the microphone back towards himself. The White House alleged that he kind of committed a semi-violent assault and released video basically with the footage kind of reversed.
It sped up to make the motion look a lot more
sudden. It was either slowed down or sped up to make it look as if he was, and cut in such a way that it looks as if Jim is pushing this woman violently away from her, when in fact he's pulling the microphone to himself. On that basis, on the basis of that footage, Jim Acosta lost his White House press credentials.
Yeah,
And the White House tweeted out the fake video. That's a shallow fake, and that's to security researchers, a shallow fake is much more of much more concern in terms of general misinformation at this point, because that is quite easy to do.
Yeah.
Putting Claire's face on Caroline's body or Brian's face on whatever is that's harder.
Yeah, yeah. Marcus Levy said during one of the exchanges with D.I. Carey was around kind of the democratisation of these kind of technologies, you know, because the barriers to entry are falling. You know, he's like, oh, you know, they're used on deep fake sort of porn sites and stuff like that, but then anyone can get their hands on it these days. So, you know, the shallow fake thing could become more prevalent because of that, if people can get their hands on the technology a lot easier than, say, these, you know, it would be a lot easier to do that than, say, a big intricate, right, we'll cut, you know, let's splice some video in and insert into a real-time data feed of, like, CCTV or something.
Yeah.
I did an interview this week with a company called World Sensing, interviewed their CTO, Albert Zaragoza, and they do a lot of Internet of Things stuff based in Barcelona. I mean, I was talking to them because of their use of a database called Influx Data, which does time series stuff and therefore feeds off sensors and things like that. But they've done a lot of smart city work. Towards the end of my interview with Albert, I asked him about facial recognition technology in urban spaces and things like that. Now, they don't get into that kind of thing, and he said this is a very delicate matter, but as a general thing, so as an expert technologist, he said, and I've got his quote, technology-wise, we are ready to recognise any person at any single point of time.
Whoa.
Well, which, of course, is the dream behind what the Chinese are doing, isn't it?
Their social...
Sharp Eyes programme.
Social monitoring and everything.
Yeah. Now, I mean, that's the sort of thing where, say you do a bit of jaywalking or you allow your dog to shit in the street and they capture your face, you lose points from the social credit system. But if you help your neighbour out with taking their rubbish out, then you get points.
It's like real life, The Good Place.
Yeah.
Do points mean prizes?
It is, actually.
Well, they mean more credit. And if, and if
I want a prize.
If you lose points, if you lose points, you can't use your WeChat app to buy things. And what's not to like about that?
That is also the premise almost of an episode of not the most recent series, but the one before that, in Black Mirror. There's an episode with Bryce Dallas where she's walking around almost just like getting points for good behaviour, bad behaviour, and as time goes on, her like rights within society strip right back.
Yeah, but they're doing that in China.
Yeah, to things like when she goes to hire a car, and it's like, oh, your point, you haven't got enough points for a nice car, you got this like old banger out here, and it doesn't quite work, and she's just like, but it's the whole, it's sort of fed into like this huge kind of Instagram like thing, like, oh, not enough people like your pictures, they don't think you look good today, so you lose points for stuff like that.
Yeah.
Not necessarily just good deeds.
It's all about popularity as well.
Yeah, so it's like the whole, a bit like an Uber rating system, but for your entire life.
So if you didn't have social media, it would be like having a bad credit score if you don't already have a credit card and try and get a mortgage.
You probably wouldn't exist in society.
Yeah, Equifax and Experian. So that sort of thing happens with us, but in China they're
expanding
it massively.
Wow.
At least that's their intention.
Yeah.
But the fact that there's that's their intention means people internalise this. So even if it's not 100% perfect, facial recognition, if you think it is, then you will internalise the socially...
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, obviously on the capture we did mention that D.I. Carey is fast-tracked.
Yes.
And I was like, that is a skills story, isn't it? Because there's like aspects where she's gone, you know, she's leapfrog all these officers, but then there's some basic stuff that she doesn't know because she hasn't done, you know, she hasn't been at the coalface, she hasn't, you know, walked.
Like what?
Yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head, but there are just things that, well, if you were a proper officer, you'd know.
You would know you can't do it like
or
that.
Or you can't move a body out and, like, and take it to a different coroner and stuff like that.
You can't just order things like that.
Yeah, so I was like, ooh, that's a skills piece.
And also because of her career path, she gets treated differently by other officers. Yeah, because DS Latif gets shouted at, doesn't she? Or DC Latif. I can't remember what her detective status is.
Well, because there's that whole, the fact she was involved in this huge case, the Sycamore case, and it's like, oh wow, she brought all these, you know, terrorists to justice and stuff like that, but her superior in her new department is like, so what? Like, I don't care. So it's like, is that, but also is that a women in IT kind of challenge as well? Like, it doesn't matter what you've achieved. Like, it's like, oh yeah, well, I don't think you've worked as hard as me, so you don't deserve it.
Yeah, if it were a bloke.
But that is also a kind of huge aspect of the storyline, because that case is based on the correction.
Yeah.
The correction that we mostly see in the capture is actually the Pilgrims of Justice. It's their gig.
Yeah.
Really, that's the thing that gets Sean fitted up. But the stuff that the security services have done have included this Operation Sycamore.
Yeah, I think there's some really good tech branding in that show. Like I say, the slogan's just sticking right, like, correction, truth reenacted. It's like, yeah, just tells me exactly what it is. Like, it's very good. Like, whoever is their marketing and comms manager, like, you know, applause.
Marketing and comms manager for the CIA.
Yeah.
Well, you can do CGI of faces and also, you know, like, reenacting of voices now as well. Didn't someone recently lose loads of money for his company because of a deep fake voice recording that he thought he was his boss? Thought it was his boss. Yeah. Because they made it sound like his boss's voice, so he just did what he was told over the phone or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they CGI'd in the One Star Wars film. They CGI'd Carrie Fisher to make her look younger so that it follows straight into A New Hope.
They've done the same to Samuel L. Jackson, didn't
they? Yeah, there is a film.
Captain Marvel.
Yeah. And is it...
De-aging him.
Yeah.
They're going to have to do that to everybody in the Marvel films eventually, because they carry on with the current lot.
A story that we've done in Computer Weekly, Angelica Murray did this week, was the just the awarding of the programme for the Home Office's biometrics programme to an American company called Leidos, whose chief operations officer is Frank Napier.
Oh, that rings a bell. Who's that?
That's the Frank character.
Oh,
Sorry, that is an easy thing to say. Yeah, bringing together fingerprints, DNA, facial record stuff, the whole shooting match, 10-year program, 300 million quid. So, you know, the state is putting a lot of welly into this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which raises the question of, what do we do about it?
We can't do anything. They can fuck us over at any point if they want to. It's quite clear.
I see what you're saying.
Very diplomatic. I see what you're saying.
Can I make a small liberal point?
If you'd like.
Because we are Computer Weekly, right? I mean, we...
Oh, what do we do as journalists?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Our journalists have testified before parliamentary select committees on like government IT projects and things like that. So we do have a little bit. I know sometimes it feels like it's just a handful of us in the room.
Chuntering.
But we do have some welly. Should we call for a ban on real-time facial recognition? Is that something we're in favour of ban on this stuff, or...?
Yeah, I think that there's lots of talk at the minute.
Banned it, haven't they?
Yeah, there's lots of talk at the moment about having it. It needs to be properly regulated and there needs more robust policy around it. It's like one of the reasons Google's given for the fact it's not willing to hand over its facial recognition APIs to law enforcers in the US, because they're like, we can't guarantee that it won't be used for nefarious things.
Well, as AWS...
hey, have it. there's a lot more regulation, probably, and I definitely think that should be a question that needs to be asked rather than just like, well, we've created this technology, go use it.
And we have just signed as well a big data sharing agreement with the US government just last week. This was covered in a story I did about encryption and Facebook, related to the encryption of data, giving the British and American law enforcement intelligence services access to one another's access to suspect data without having to go through the tech companies.
Is that like an extension to the Cloud Act?
Yeah,
because that's what we were talking about that quite a lot at OVH last week, this week.
Yeah, and so that's coming in now, and I can't imagine that the Brits will make too many requests of the Americans, but I can imagine the American intelligence services being very interested in the activities of some British activists.
Mm.
It's not going to be. I think that's a problematic agreement that we should not have signed.
My trip this week, one of the things OVH, this cloud provider, one of their selling points is that we're a European provider, so we are exempt from the Cloud Act. So unlike Amazon and Microsoft and Google, if you give us your data, we don't necessarily have to hand it over to US law enforcers, you know, because it's not on, you know, US servers basically. So we, you know, you should keep your data with us, which is that's fine. But as some people have pointed out, OVH do have data centers in the US, so the Cloud Act would still apply there. But yeah, it's kind of being used as a bit of a marketing or selling tool, like a point of, you know, competitive difference.
Is it possible to guarantee, Caroline, when placing your data with an OVH or an AWS or whatever, that it will be housed in a country that has strong data protection laws? So if you wanted to reside your data in such a place where the let's use America as the example because it's the best one, where they couldn't get at it. Mm. That is something you can do.
That's one of the reasons why all the big cloud providers have opened data centers around the world. Obviously, people say, oh, it's for latency, but also data security and sovereignty is a big part of that conversation as well, because there's a tendency for enterprises to stipulate that we want, if we're going to use your services, we want the data stored in our own country so we know exactly where we are from a data regulation and protection standpoint. So yes, it's I've seen it in the consult with AWS. You say, I want my data, it should be in London, please.
Sorry if it seems like a daft question. I'm on a very
fact-finding mission.
The learning curve, as I think I said last week, the learning curve since I've become security editor looks more like a vertical cliff face. So
you're scaling it well.
Yeah.
Got the crampons out. Yeah.
So I mean, from a technology point of view, a lot of the stuff we've been talking about facial recognition, computer vision, etc. kind of comes down to there's now lots and lots of big data, machine learning, which I think the security services, I mean, it's not like they planned this.
No.
They didn't say, oh, all those machine learning algorithms developed in the 70s that have lain in dusty books. And now, you know, let's have a whole bunch of big data so we can take advantage of that. So it's just something that's kind of fallen into their lap, unlike in China, where they are actually kind of going for this in a very kind of conscious way. But cloud computing, huge enabler of all this stuff, isn't it, Caroline?
Or is it?
Tell us about your trips.
Is it?
well, I'll tell you about my trip, actually. My hometown is Hayes in Middlesex. That's where I was born. And so I went on an 11-hour flight.
How long is this going to take?
Not long. I went on an 11-hour flight
Copperfield.
To end up in Hayes in San Jose. I was like, oh, Hayes, oh, the cool town of Hayes. We're not twinned, I found out, which is a shame. But yeah, so that was for the Net Events Global IT Summit. And it's an interesting event in that there's loads of panels on lots of different subjects like artificial intelligence, multi-cloud, edge data centres, big data, and how enterprises are using all that stuff. And then there's like speed dating sessions in the afternoon where you sit down and have five or six back-to-back briefings with five other journalists, but with like suppliers sat in front of you pitching, sort of like, this is what we do, talk to us. So it's pretty full-on couple of days.
That sounds packed, jam-packed.
It was jam-packed. But yeah, one of the things that did come out of that, and also in combination with this, the ODH trip I went to last week, is this kind of changing relationship that enterprises seem to be having with cloud now. So 5 or 6 years ago, AWS and others were sort of saying, oh, enterprises, they'll just want to close down their data centers and move everything into the cloud, go all in on cloud. And then as time's gone on, that sort of softened a bit. AWS have, but others have as well, around saying, actually, maybe not everything will move to the cloud. Maybe for sort of legacy reasons, we can't afford to re-architect applications and move those to cloud, that have to stay on premise. So there's always been this, okay, so maybe not everything will move. But now there's this, all these discussions about maybe organizations that have moved everything to the public cloud, finding maybe the hype doesn't quite live up to the reality. So things like when you, okay, right, we'll go all in, and then finding out actually the time it will take from a networking perspective to physically move our data is going to take forever. And then the cost of actually shifting that data, the transmission costs, are just too prohibitive. So there's this thing now that maybe, like, because companies want to use big data, want to do machine learning and these kind of really data processing heavy initiatives, that maybe it's the idea isn't to move everything to the cloud, maybe it's to move those services back on premise. And leave your data there and then just work on it. So, and you know, that gives rise to more things like, you know, edge computing environments, hybrid cloud, private cloud and stuff like that. So maybe, yeah, everything's shifting again, which is something
it's good for you.
Well, yeah, so it gives me loads more stuff to write about. People, you know, phone up all the people I've written stories about, oh, I'm going all in on the cloud, like, oh, you're coming back. But no, it's something I'd obviously go to a lot of cloud conferences, and there's always been, over the last couple of years, maybe like a case study here and there of someone saying, oh, we're moving part of it back now, but it's never been a huge trend. But to go to two conferences on the bounce where it's talked about as a trend quite comprehensively was really, really interesting from quite a, like, say from a supplier point of view where OBH are concerned, but also from like analysts and end users at Net Events as well. I just thought it was really interesting.
It's funny because I've recently had two events on the bounce where there was a theme, a common theme. I'm like, are you all speaking to each other to come up with these consistent, you know, like,
it's that light bulb, like, oh my god, there's a trend, there's a trend,
there's a trend, you have to write a feature.
Exactly. So but yeah, it was so that's probably one of the biggest things. But the OVH story was quite interesting because, like I say, they were talking about Cloud Act, but they're a 20-year-old cloud company, but they're undergoing a rebrand, so not OVH anymore, they're OVH Cloud because they're a cloud company.
Of course.
And 70% of their revenues this year now come from cloud, but over the years they've gone from being like an ISP, a telco, everything, they've just gone through all these different evolutions, and now they are the apparently one of the world's top 10 cloud providers who no one has heard of.
Mm.
So they're on a
very on trend.
So they're going on a bit of a marketing offensive, which is why I was out in Paris to find out a bit more about them. And it's just interesting because, you know, we mention all the time Microsoft, Amazon, Google, those people.
Yes,
they've kind of conquered,
right. Yeah.
They've conquered the cloud, if you like.
Right.
So hearing,
space, yeah.
Yeah, so
yeah.
Then to hear of like a smaller provider and seeing them, tracking them, going through all the various changes you need, strategy, trying to work through like how do we, you know, go from being one of the top 10 to one of the top 5 or top 3 is, really was, it's a bit more of an interesting thing to report on rather than, oh, here's an all conquering company just getting bigger. Here's a company that's having a go and see what happens next.
And is your travelling over for the time being?
Yes, potentially, for at least the next 2 weeks. Although I've got a holiday, but that doesn't count.
Yeah.
I'm going to Hastings, there'll be hopefully no clouds there. I want some.
Yeah, you want sunshine. You want to get away from the clouds.
Yeah.
And you're off to Vegas for a Splunk.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Via my annual Buffy convention.
Yeah. And Alex, you... Travelling?
I'm going to Prague right before Brexit Day.
Oh.
And I have a couple of...
Dangerous.
But I should be back in the country in good time.
Let's hope.
Just in case. I've got an invitation to Monaco for a cybersecurity thing.
Oh, it's hard.
It's really interesting. So
yeah.
Very glad.
That
I haven't been to Monaco for a long time.
Do you all enjoy the camp show?
Yes.
I thought it was really good.
I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it.
I thought it was compelling. We said, we're going to watch it.
Better than Line of Duty and
no.
The Bodyguard?
I'd say it's better than Bodyguard, but not better than Line of Duty.
Not seen any of them.
Straw poll.
I saw the first episode of The Bodyguard. And then I watched it through Gogglebox, basically.
Yeah, I thought it was really hammy in the end, Bodyguard on reflection.
It was, and that last episode was... full power.
It's the first bit of broadcast telly I've watched in a long time, with the exception of The Planets with Professor Brian Cox. I usually enjoyed it. I mostly watch binge Netflix stuff at the minute, so a little BBC miniseries was quite a nice treat.
And Drag Race UK.
Well, this won't be the last of our TV themed podcasts. We've been watching The Circle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which finishes next week, so we may discuss that next.
I need to catch up because my travels mean I've not been able to watch a nightly reality show and keep up to date with it.
So you've been missing a lot.
Yeah.
It's wild in there.
It is pretty mental.
I love
it.
Are you enjoying it, Brian?
Yeah, Richard Madeley described it as the most...
Yeah, I heard he's
innovative reality TV show that there is.
Yeah, they made Richard Madeley go in as a...
And
a fake.
And pretend to be someone else.
Yeah, catfish, yeah.
Judy,
yeah.
I bet she sat at home on spitting out her tea like, what?
Not actually Judy.
She was a 27-year-old Judy, though.
Nutritionist.
Yeah.
He had to get everyone to turn on him.
Yeah.
/ her.
Which he was successful in doing.
Yeah.
He's worked in TV a long time. I'm sure he's honed those skills.
Yeah. I liked his typewriter, by the way.
Yeah, that was cool. They gave him a typewriter.
Cool.
Because
he
said that in the downtime he wanted to work on his book, and they said you can't have your laptop, so they gave him a typewriter.
I didn't see him doing much work on it, to be fair.
Maybe we should save this for next week,
because
I'll get deep into it.
Yes.
So much viewing to do.
Yeah.
That's all we've got time for this week, because we've got lots of viewing to do. Thank you very much, Caroline, and welcome back.
Thank you, and thank you.
Thank you, Claire.
Anytime.
Thanks for coming back, Alex. And
anytime.
Thanks to you, gentle listener, for listening. Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.